Legislative and Public Affairs Subcommittee meeting, December 10, 2019, 6:30 p.m. Yeah, number two, notification of open meetings and act posting and announcement of meeting proceeding. A copy of the Open Meetings Act, Nebraska Revised Statute 84.14.7 through 84.14.14, posted on the back wall of the meeting. Prior to turning to the agenda for tonight's meeting, I'd like to announce the procedure that will be used. With respect to each agenda item, the directors will first hear staff proposals and recommendations. Then the public will be given the opportunity to speak to the item. Lastly, the directors will discuss the item and take action. We ask that the public not interrupt the directors' discussion and action. Thank you. And I have proof of publication of tonight's meeting. Roll call.
Grunwald.
Yes.
Jeff.
Yes.
McCormick.
Here.
Sapinski.
Here.
And Chairperson.
Director Sapinski is moving on to Director. Item number four, adoption of agenda.
Motion. Second.
Motion and second. Any discussion, directors? Not. Roll call.
Jeff.
Yes.
McCormick.
Yes.
Sapinski.
Yes.
Grunwald. And Chairperson.
Aye. And I think I just stated that the publication. So I move on to item number six. Review and recommendation of 2020 pay program administration manual. Gene Tate and Ashley. I want to have to say that.
I'll get it. Good evening. I'm here tonight with Ashley Tamala. She's the senior consultant, HR consulting for Silverstone Group, to present the proposed changes to the district's pay program administration manual for 2020. This year, Silverstone is recommending a 2.2% increase to the base pay structure, as supported by their compensation planning bulletin for 2020 and the U.S. World at Work salary budget survey, which is presented on the board. This recommendation is consistent with prior year updates to the district's paid program manual on the years a market analysis isn't conducted. Also proposed is a recommended change to the relationship to market matrix chart. This would increase the lump sum percentage for the performance rating in the category of greater than 100%. The primary reason for this change is to allow for tenured employees that fall within this category to be rewarded between a 1 to 4% increase. Currently, those employees can only receive a merit increase of 0 to 3%. This would address pay disparity for tenured employees that meets the district's expectations and are limited to a 0 to 1% increase. The cost of living was 1.6 for this past year, and the average pay increase for district employees has been 3% for the year of 2019. A highlighted version of the proposed 2020 pay manual is attached for your review. Our recommendation is that the subcommittee recommend to the Board of Directors that the proposed amendments to the pay program administration manual for 2020 be adopted and incorporated to the district's policy manual. And Ashley and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
We have a motion.
I'll move for the staff recommendation.
Second.
Directors?
Who's up first?
I had a question regarding just the basic pay scale here. You start minimum, midpoint, maximum. Just a general anything, a 7, for instance. How long does it take to go from minimum to midpoint, for instance? How long do you need to be employed? It goes up every year, correct?
It does, for each of the categories. The minimum, midpoint, and maximum are assigned to the pay grades at the time we do the market analysis. And the minimum is 80% of the midpoint, and the maximum is 120% of the midpoint. So it really vary from person to person depending on how the district hires them. They don't always start somebody out at 80% at the midpoint if they come in with years of experience or certification documentation of equipment and their degrees.
Right, so, I understand, but let's say you start at the minimum. How many years does it take to be employed to reach the midpoint?
It would depend on their performance appraisals as well.
What,
yeah,
is
so
there average at all? Or? possible to become to the midpoint?
No.
The expectation is that anybody who is meeting expectations would fall around that midpoint of their pay grade.
But if you start, how long would it take to reach the midpoint? Is it 3 years? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years on average? Is it possible you could be employed here and never reach even the midpoint?
No.
It would vary from employee to employee. But again, it depends on the performance.
And this chart changes. So every year when we come in, there's no, well, I think the last couple of years has been a 2.2% increase to the pay scale. So let's just say somebody is currently at 97% of their midpoint and they're due for their evaluation after this, they'd then be at 95%. So it kind of keeps them between the 90 to 100 and 20%. I'm going to reference a page, and Bill, if you could go to, and in your handbook, if you could go to page 15 on the actual page. And it'll show the relationship to market. Oh, wrong one. Go back to that chart that you had, the first chart. There we go. Okay, so if you will scroll down, up, other way, other down. Okay, so this is the relationship to market. So you have employees that are under 80%, between 80 and 89%, 90 and 109%, 110 and 120%. So if they receive a rating of meets expectations, they would fall in a category two. So depending on how they were hired and what they received, you can see that they could vary between getting a 0% to a 2.5%, or if you consider the lump sum payout, it could be between 3 to 4%.
That's in addition to a cost of living increase.
No, we have not received a cost of living increase in a number of years.
So my question is, if everything's going up 2 or 3% a year, starting at the minimum, how do you ever that keeps going up every year?
That's based on merit. The general manager can also reward employees that continually far exceed expectations. He can award them 1%.
Okay. It just seems like if they're doing the basic duties of the job, at least that, after an X number of years, they should at least be at the minimum.
I would have to go through, and I could do an assessment. I could do an analysis to give you that information for every individual, if you would like that, based on years of service. And
most everybody's been here for 5 years. I mean,
right. If you're here a minimum of 5 to 7 years, have you reached the midpoint? Most people.
Most people have by that point, at 5 to 7 years.
Yeah. I would have to. I don't have the information.
I think that would be wise to find that out to some degree, to see if you're here 5 to 7 years, you should be at almost the midpoint of the pace.
I was curious
as to why that would be.
I would say that's close, but we can look for sure.
Okay.
Boy, Ted, I think you're going right down the right vein here. I want to see. Board need to figure out who's doing what, and it's not a disagree or agree. So I'm asking for a copy of all employee assessments. But it is our, we have the right to review the board.
I don't think so.
Legal. Mr. Brett?
There's a personnel decision.
Again, it's just a review because you're asking for increases, and I think you have to watch for my constituency's funds, and that means I get to review. What's our timeframe? So my request again, sir.
I think we're, Mr. Chair, that we're trying to approve the administration.
Any other directors have questions? But very much yes, sir. This is affecting everybody. They have information so we can make quality decisions.
Well, I think he indicated he'll get back to you in a couple of days. Roll call.
Wait, I think Rich did.
Well, I guess I would oppose Solid Director Runwald. I see this as being our general manager's job and not the job of this director's group. We have no way of knowing how Dean Tate or whomever is working, you know, functioning, and that's not our job. You know, we are policymakers, not management. Management decisions, salary is made by the GM. We make policy, not sit here and
reviewing is not policy.
Well,
I'll look forward to Mr.
Myers. I would not be comfortable with that.
Well, roll call.
McCormick.
Yes.
Kinski.
Yes.
Runwald.
Yeah.
Yes.
Chairperson.
Aye. Item number 7, review and recommendation on update to the district employee handbook.
Hello again.
Thanks, Ashley.
Tonight I'm here to present you the proposed changes to the district's employee handbook. A copy of my memo with the detailed changes and a redline version of the handbook can be found in the in your book behind PLPA tab agenda item number 7. I've highlighted the proposed changes that are, I'll highlight the proposed changes that are other than housekeeping in nature, and if you have any additional questions, you can go ahead and let me know. The first one was changing the definition of exempt salaried employees. Updating the definition of those employees removes the wording that exempt employees receive extra pay for emergency operations work. Flex work arrangements removes the requirement for a flex time acknowledgement form, as this is coordinated and approved by supervisors. Emergency operations work requires overtime pay for emergency operations work performed by salaried employees be approved by a majority vote of the board. FMLA requires employees to apply for FMLA when more than 5 consecutive days are needed to tend to their own or family members' serious health condition and requires reasonable notification to the district. Retirement plan adds time previously worked at any NRD to count towards the 6 months of retirement eligibility. Travel and express accounts requires itemized receipts be submitted for reimbursement. Electronic communication systems requires requirement for password updates to change from semi-annually to not required unless the password is compromised. And media inquiries changes the primary point of contact for media inquiries to the Public Relations Education Programs Manager. Upon board approval of the updated handbook, it will be distributed to all employees for their verification and acknowledgement. The recommendation is that the subcommittee recommend to the Board of Directors that the proposed amended language to the employee handbook be approved and incorporated to the district's policy. And I, or the general manager, would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Would we have a motion?
I move for staff recommendation.
Second.
A motion and a second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors?
I would just like a little clarification on for salary people. How is that? That work under this particular?
So the change was in the emergency operations work. Salaried employees are not eligible for overtime pay on a normal basis. However, during emergency events, it has been the past policy that salaried employees are eligible for overtime during those extremes. So, for example, this last event in March 2019 was an emergency situation. The general manager has never eligible for OT. I'm 24/7, 365, so I'm scratched. But for example, Marlon and Bill Warren and some others are eligible for that. So the question was, I think Director Teaser wanted that removed. So it's not automatic, so then it has to be, if the board approves to do that, then it'd be brought to the board with those totals to be approved instead of just automatic.
Does it need to be a declared emergency by the board before this takes effect then, or is it just any overtime situation?
No, it wouldn't be just any overtime situation. It'd have to be an emergency nature. So it'd have to be flood related. It doesn't necessarily have to be, an emergency declared by the board, but it has to be an emergency nature. Majority of the time, though, it is an emergency declared by the board. It's very few and far between that this is ever used.
No, so the change would be the fact now that it's not automatically going to be paid in an emergency situation.
Right.
It has to come before the board?
For approval, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Director Brandon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, is there anything to compare to across the state?
All the NRDs have separate employee handbooks and policies that govern based on their individual NRDs. None of them are the same.
This has been done for, Marlon, how long has this been a policy? I don't know what the other districts do.
Could you go ahead.
I was just asking for clarification. When you said emergency declaration was not the only criteria, the other one was?
Emergency. It would be of an emergency nature.
What does that mean?
For example, say the Missouri River was forecasted to reach a certain stage at 1:30 in the evening or in the early morning, and we had gates open. That would be an emergency that Bill Warren or one of his crew go down and close those gates. So that would be an emergency nature. That's just throwing out there. I'm sure Martin Cleveland and Marlin can think of a million more, but that's something that would obviously got to
be done.
It has to be done, or there'd be, Marlin, you can,
another. One of the things that looked at is whether the national.
It would be something that could not be done during normal business hours. But it has to be done. It can't be morning or normal business hours.
What percent, just curious, are exempt of NRD here?
Not off the top of my head, but I can get it.
Second question, so this change just impacts exempt salaried employees?
Yeah, this applies to exempt salaried employees,
okay.
not hourly employees.
Does that change anything for the hourly employees
no.
by doing this? In other words,
they still get overtime.
Okay, so that's not going to take away if people that are hourly, if they kind of built into the cake for their salaries or their wages, that's not going to impact them at all.
It doesn't
adversely.
Impact them at all. No.
Okay.
They still get their overtime. It's just the salary.
Okay.
Roll call.
Yes.
Renwald.
No.
Jeff.
Yes.
McCormick.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, quick question. Staff or Brent, Mr. Murray, when you respond to me, that will be a legal opinion. It will be a. Thank you, sir.
You again?
Yeah, yes.
You're on a roll.
Yeah, I guess. Director Bradley is sitting in for Director Fowler.
Yes, sir.
Consultant Selection Subcommittee, RFP for Papio Channel Culver's Rehabilitation Project, Professional Services, December 10th. Already read the
Form call.
Bakley.
Here.
Bradley.
Here.
McCormick.
Here.
Thompson.
Here.
Chairperson.
I agree.
Adoption of agenda. Motion.
Second.
Roll call.
First of all, who seconded?
I did.
Okay, Bakley. Okay, thank you. Bradley.
Yes.
Bakley.
Aye.
McCormick.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
Chairperson.
Aye. Approval of invitation of the meeting notice. Item number six, review and recommendation on initial screening of proposals for consultant selection interviews.
As the committee and also the rest of the board knows, we received 8 proposals from the list of people on the board. JEO, FIRA, Olson, Schimmer, Benish, HGR, Snyder, and Kirkham-Michael. And so you've all probably have seen and reviewed these proposals. As always, it's usually challenging to narrow it down because there's always a lot of qualified consultants in the area to pose on these projects. So staff has reviewed these proposals ourselves as well and have our opinion, I guess, of who you may want to interview. Typically, would interview 3 or 4 is usually the number of people that you select. And they would be interviewed then in January 2nd would be the interview date. And so that would be, again, that's kind of where we're at as far as this is, again, to actually design and construction administration for 47 deficient storm sewers or culverts on the Little Papio project. We have roughly 150 culverts on that project, and 47 of those are in a condition that need to be rehabilitated or replaced in some form or another. So this consultant would actually design that and also guide what should be done with those 47 culverts to adhere to the Corps engineer's requirements and keep the project in good standing with the Corps and keep the project also in safe condition for district to operate and maintain. So that's kind of an overview of what we're doing here in general. So,
Martin, and Director McCormick brought this to my attention a few weeks ago. Now, as committee members, you can decide what time of day, dates we have to kind of gauge it to when the board meetings are, when the subcommittee meetings are. However, if you want to have a specific time of day, if the committee can agree, for example, they don't always have to be at night. I'm sure the consultants would also be happy if they were more in during business hours. So if the committee wants it besides another time in the evening, please let us know, and then we can schedule that for when the interviews are. So just to let everybody know.
Are there similar projects in the past and have that you've had recently with these consultants? Is there a history that you have?
We have. We've completed one phase of the Big Papio, which is phase one. That consisted of 13 culverts. That was done by FIRA Engineering, did the design and construction administration, and then phase two was also done by that firm. There's 16 culverts, and that's under construction right now. We're about halfway through with that project.
That's also FIRA?
FIRA as well. Obviously had a fair amount of experience with Big Papio, which is similar to Little Papio in terms of how do you do culverts.
Anyone else?
Well, if anyone wants
anyone else with the district, at least. I mean, another
right. I read the proposal.
Right. Yeah.
Well, before we get into it, is anyone from the public wish to speak to this? Directors. Okay. Well.
Is there a recommendation from the staff? Or
Martin, I believe the recommendation is to interview 4 consultants. FIRA, HGR, JEO, and Olson.
I know you sometimes do 4, sometimes 3, mostly 3. I think any of these can do the job. There's a couple of notes on that I made. One is a lot of out-of-town employees, so kind of didn't make the cutoff. But I think three would be quite adequate of the top three. Ira Olson and HDR.
Second that.
Any other comments from directors? Motion on the floor and a second.
No, I said one of the firms has a lot of other town employees doing the work.
Oh, thank you.
Speaking when consultants out of town come in, do a lot of work, you're paying for a lot of travel. There's plenty of local firms to do that. In my opinion, more favorable.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I am an alternate on this committee, and I just perhaps want to clarify for my decision, and I'll probably vote for this motion, but that the NRD, Pappy, Missouri NRD, we didn't exclude anybody if they may have been from out of state or out of town. Because I think there's a interstate commerce clause in the Constitution of the United States that one state cannot prevent another state from coming in and doing business. And I just want the public to know that that's not what we're doing here. I am voting.
Motion on the floor and a second.
Bakley?
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Aye. That concludes.
Keep on running.
All the order of the programs, projects, operations, subcommittee meeting, and submission. We've already read the Open Meetings Act, so applies. Quorum call.
Bradley?
Here.
Jack?
Here.
Sapinski?
Here.
Beezer?
Here.
Chairperson?
Aye. Adoption of agenda?
So move.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any questions? Roll call.
Jack?
Here.
Sapinski?
Yes.
Beezer?
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Aye. Item number six, review and recommendation of Lower Platte River Consortium Drought Contingency Plan.
All right, good evening. I do have a few couple slides to go through to kind of provide just a little bit of background. And John Engel with HDR is here. He was primary author or project manager over the development of the plan here. So we were actually here a couple months ago. We just presented an extension to the interlocal agreement between the consortium members. That was passed till next September of 2020. Go on to the next slide if you're all right. I guess I have the slide control, don't I? So some of the background is this stems from work that was done throughout the entire Lower Platte Basin. That includes the Loops and the Elkhorn, and then the what we consider the Lower Platte sub-basin, which is basically us, Lower Platte North and Lower Platte South. As we went through that effort, we did see that there was usually excess, what we considered excess flows or excess water a majority of the time. It was only shortages in some years in the midsummer months. So in terms of that, we've got a plan together that we're doing right now where new irrigation, new uses are continuing to go on in the Lower Platte Basin, in the Loops, in the Elkhorn, and in our areas. We've set an allotment for everybody to do so much development every year, and we've been keeping track of that with this accounting. So there is that available, and we're actually developing below even those thresholds that we thought we were. So as of what is 2.5 years into a 5.5 year time frame, which is about 40%, we've only used about 20% or less of the available development that could have gone on. And even that's ratcheting things out over 50 years of effort here. So that's still going pretty well. You know, we're not developing at such a rapid rate that we're going to get ourselves into issues. However, when we were doing that plan, it was also noted that, you know, dry conditions still occur on the plat. There's still times where we're not meeting the flow requirements for Loop Power District or the in-stream flows downstream that are set for the pallid sturgeon, things like that. So we do have times of shortage, and those times of shortage not only affect those two things I mentioned, they also affect the municipal partners here with Lincoln and MUD. So that's why we all kind of got together and decided it was necessary to look at what should we be doing, what kind of things should we be working together on if a drought scenario occurs. So I've already mentioned the consortium members. They include the Lincoln and MUD, plus the Department of Natural Resources is involved with us here. The total plan cost was around $550,000. Of that, the Bureau of Reclamation, through their Water Smart Grant, provided 36%, Water Sustainability Funding, 35%, and then the consortium members split the rest, which was about a little less than 5% each. So we've already put in the $26,000 that's been part of the interlocal agreement. The process, just to go through, you know, this has gone on since August of 2016. Over the 3 years, we've pretty much held nearly bi-monthly meetings of the group to make sure we're tracking and we're doing the things we should as far as getting the plan done. We had stakeholder workshops where we discussed a little bit more of the technical details of what was going on in the plan. And then two public open houses have already occurred. And it was pretty much after that December 2018 plan, we actually brought that to the board last year to say, is this draft good enough to submit to the Bureau for their review? It was passed by everybody, all of the members. So it did go in around February for the Bureau's review. So they've been spending the latter few months back and forth a little bit with HDR on a couple things. But ultimately in October, they approved the final part of that plan with very minor changes, right, John? For the most part. So pretty much mostly the plan we submitted is the plan we still have in place. And so I just want to make sure we know tonight this is what the plan does and doesn't do. So the plan right now would just establish monitoring and communication protocols. Like, we're going to try to get ahead of, and I'll show you this in a diagram here. Try to get ahead of knowing when drought may occur, like what are the conditions looking like going into a drought period. And we're using our local data plus more national data to kind of assess that. The coordination amongst our different groups, amongst the municipalities and the NRDs, provides further eligibility for more funding through the Bureau as time goes on. And it's an opportunity to further investigate potential mitigation actions, which I'll touch on here. This is an outline of really what we're agreeing to do right now is to have a couple meetings each year and then have various phone calls as we're reviewing some of the information about what the drought monitoring conditions say. You know, that might be river flows, groundwater conditions. At the end of the year here, we can kind of report on that. As you get to more of the April, March and April timeframe of next year, you can start to see some of the snowpack implications on drought in the Platte River Basin. And then if we did get to the point where something needs to be done, all we're talking about doing right now is just the individual things each of our agencies has the authority to do. So it might be Lincoln putting out water restrictions so that they use less water each day. It might be the NRD looking at cutting back a little bit on new development or water usage, which was within our right to do. We currently don't have rules and regs right now that would do that. But those are the kind of things we can keep an eye on. So what doesn't the plan do? It doesn't require us to do anything that we're not already doing. And that goes along for Lincoln and MUD. Also, it doesn't dictate certain projects or programs that we would be required to either further investigate or implement, and it doesn't infringe on our local decision-making. So just want to make sure that was clear as we look at the plan. Just to highlight some of the drought management actions, so that's what we're mostly focused on. There was a bunch of projects and programs in the plan, as you can remember. varying from, you know, different types of dams to seepage from canals, different ideas to basically retime water, put it back into the river system when it's going to be needed in those latter summer months. I've talked about some of the individual response actions that can still be taken place, varying rate structures, things like that. So we've talked about that. Those kind of operate independent of this actual plan. We can, of course, work together on a coordinated public messaging. So everybody's saying the same thing going into certain drought conditions, things like that. And then these potential mitigation actions looked at, I'm not going to go through each one of them. You can kind of see they all have a little bit different focus on where they're getting the water, how they're storing the water, how they're going to make water available. And some of it depends on where they're at within this bigger basin, because timing and stuff does make a difference. So basically in this chart, what we're looking at is this is the amount of water that might be available from these different actions down at Ashland. So there is some losses that occur there. And then based on the cost estimate, which was brought forward in this plan, you know, here's how effective each one of those are at, based on the amount of water you get and how much they cost, how effective are they? So that was looked at for each of these. But, you know, just to be certain right now, we're not saying we're going forward with any of these. They're just part of this plan. Really, they're in the plan because it makes them potentially eligible for funding sometime in the future if that was ever the case that was looked at. So the next steps are each of the members are going forward and adopting the plan. I know Lower Platte North has it, had it on their agenda, and Lower Platte South will have it this month on their agenda too. So the NRDs are doing that. Right now the agreement is extended till next September, which has Lower Platte South continuing as the administrative lead for everything. We'll probably, again, hold maybe a couple of those meetings to get us used to doing that, figuring out what kind of data we're going to look at, those things. And then there's also a possibility of a tabletop exercise, like what would happen if some of those drought mitigation measures were, or drought response actions were put in place. For instance, like if the Department of Natural Resources said the flow on the river is too low, we're going to make a call and restrict other water users within the upstream of the Platte River Ashland area. So that was one of the thoughts in that tabletop exercise. So that's really what we're looking at going forward and approving right now. And so possibility would be that you get to next September and we decide we're going to continue the consortium for another 3 years, again, just to meet and review drought issues going on. Yep.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors?
Paul, do we still have the sand pit augmentation, Lake Plagueis, for example?
The dam augmentation project?
Yeah, you know, pumping out of the sand pits into the river?
Oh, yeah, it is still, in general, it's looked at as a possibility. I don't know if that's, if it would ever be that specific area or what that is, but the idea of having it pumped out of the sand pits is looked at.
Not real popular out there, I thought, right?
No, there was several unpopular, yeah.
Director Bradley, then.
Chairman, when they say possible mitigation actions, users on the river, that include the ethanol?
It would only be those that have an actual, more than likely on that first response, surface water rights. So most of the ethanol plants are pulling groundwater, is my understanding. Then it would be up to the NRDs to make cutbacks on those if that was the case.
Of energy in. X amount of energy out, and in that equation, it accounts for a lot of water out. Else, in my opinion.
Yep.
Director Thompson, then Director Gatt.
Cormick.
So do you know that if the surface irrigation or the well irrigation is the cause of your late summer droughts? Or is it you're only looking at the surface?
No, the study that was done for the basin looked at all uses within the basin, so it accounted for groundwater uses and it accounted for surface water uses, and it kind of pooled everything together. And
somewhat equal problems or causes?
Yeah, through modeling different scenarios, we understand how much a groundwater well causes an impact on the river. We also know that, you know, somebody diverting water from the river, they're 100% of that water is being extracted. So
where do the potential mitigation actions go if you're just having table talk? Are we looking to implement them down the road, or it's not like you're going to build a pipeline or reservoirs during the drought to mitigate the drought?
Right. No, these would have to be projects that we'd have to determine made economic sense and that we should do them, you know, ahead of time. They're not going to be implemented while the drought is occurring or something to that
effect. And is that one of your functions, is to decide if those are?
I mean, I would say some evaluation is going to continue, but not extensively on any one of these particular items. So, for instance, if really the cutbacks and the shortages are maybe we solve Lincoln's problems first, some of that may be done on, I think, noted here that, for instance, like MUD and Lincoln Water are still evaluating an interconnection between each other. So if that would help alleviate Lincoln's water shortage issues at times, then perhaps there's not going to be a lot of these other big scale mitigation projects to put water back into the river necessarily. Because there's certainly some inefficiencies with, I put this much water in the river, only a small percentage of that is actually ever used by Lincoln. But on the other hand, if the river goes dry, we're not meeting those other requirements either, which is in-stream flow for the wildlife habitat in the area.
I was just trying to get a handle on why we're studying this and where it should go. And are there further study costs going to be associated with updating the study? And
there's not any further additional study costs at this time, huh?
Well, I think, Director McCormick, ties in with your question a little bit. A year or a year and a half ago, I was in Lincoln at the Lower Platte South, and I think there at that point, we had a public display of those exact things up there. Has there been further movement on that as far as prioritizing those or not? I'm curious just how serious we are about pursuing one of those options, or they're just in the planning stage, or we're looking at them, we're trying to prioritize them.
Right.
Just what? Because I've got some constituents in the northern Arlington area just called me very recently and was inquiring as to the status.
Right. John Engel with HDR. Yeah, I think was it Supervisor Kruger that was at the? Yeah. He's and all that information and the article that was in the Blair paper, that's all included in the report, the final report that's in there for documentation. No, there hasn't been any further refinements done on these. I think that what Paul is referring to is that tabletop exercise, I think, is really the next step. We've identified, you know, a bunch of different options that could potentially put water in the river during drought periods. They're all a substantial chunk of money. And the tabletop exercise is really to try to prioritize which of those are effective during a drought. We looked at 2012 when we were developing them as kind of the flash drought, the worst drought conditions in the Lower Platte. We're going to use that information and look at, of each of these mitigation measures, which one are most effective in mitigating some of the impacts that occurred in 2012 in a tabletop exercise, and then to do something, repeat 2012 the next year. Because I think that's one of the big concerns, like on some of the reservoirs, like on Skunk Creek, on Bell Creek, is It may be there for 2012, but what happens if we had back-to-back drought conditions on a structure that relies on runoff, and if you're in the middle of the drought, it very likely didn't fill. What would it be like on the second year? And so that's kind of the way that we're going to kind of go through and test each of these mitigation measures, and hopefully some prioritize some of those that, that may be moved to the top and would be evaluated in more detail at that time.
There is no priority order at this time.
There is not.
Also kind of looked at, like, none of these are the exact silver bullet to solve the answer either. They're talking about providing 100 CFS to a river. Well, that moves the needle a little bit in a very big river.
Right. And quite frankly, the only real drought-resistant source is the Missouri River. You know, all the other ones are in some degree or some are susceptible to drought conditions.
Any other questions?
Paul, you, at the very beginning, you said 20% of the development.
So we had outlined a certain amount of development that the lower Platte NRDs would allow in the 5.5-year horizon. So we've only used up 20% of that allotment.
20% of the plan.
20% of the plan and 40% of the time. So we're...
You're behind.
Right.
We're doing
good.
Thanks. John, was it?
Yeah.
John, does Lincoln still hold primacy on the Platte River as far as water flow?
Well, they have on surface water, it's a priority, right? And they're junior to some. They are senior to, and that's kind of puts in context some of these numbers that you see up there in the 50 to 100 million range. They are a senior to about 100,000 acres in the basin. And they would have the ability during a drought, they've never done it, but they would have the ability to put a priority call on the river and shut off that number of acres.
But the point is they have options.
They do. It's an option, there's always... As part of this study, we tried to get, it was kind of a back-of-the-napkin estimate, and I think we'll put some more effort into it. But, of course, in a surface water right, when you put a call on the river because you're short, it doesn't automatically guarantee you water because water...
So if the state of Colorado is successful at cutting off the Platte River, what are we going to do?
Well... Yeah. That's interesting. They do. They have a funding source now. with their gambling tax. But that's an interesting point. Typically, the worst case conditions in the lower Platte are when the upper Platte becomes completely disconnected. Like in 2012, the Platte dried up through Grand Island. So I guess if Colorado starts using more, that could occur more frequently. But
talking about diverting the whole thing.
Yeah.
Thank you, John.
You have questions? Roll call.
I move that we go with staff recommendations.
Second.
Roll call.
Yes.
Caesar?
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
Manager?
Thank you. Item number 7, review and recommendation on lead bridge debris removal contract. Eric Newlands.
Good evening, everyone. This is a project we've talked about a few times in recent months. The removal of the debris along the lead bridge, the pedestrian bridge of the Platte River, between Highway 31 and South Bend. We had previously bid this project opening in November. We received one bid, and last month the board decided to not award the contract due to the high price of that bid. We opened bids again on December 3rd. This time we received 6 bids. We had put in a substantial amount of work to contact additional contractors this time, and that was very successful. We also made a modification to the timeline for the completion of the work. Originally, we had asked that all of the work be completed by January 31st, meaning in the winter, to avoid the potential that the debris might cause ice jams and lead to potential risk of ice jam flooding in the area. We have modified the description of the timeline to give some preference for work to be done by January 31st, with an additional secondary preference by April 1st, prior to the nesting and spawning season for a threatened and endangered species, and then a final deadline to be by October 15th. So that extended timeline was based on responses we got from both the contractor who did bid the first time and additional contractors who did not bid the first time. So all of that together led to six bids, ranging from $211,250 up to $749,500, with the apparent low bid of $211,250 from National Concrete Cutting, based in Council Bluffs, Iowa. The district has not worked with this contractor before, so we requested some additional information about the type of equipment they would use, whether it was owned or would be rented, the access that they intended for the site, as well as references, and we received three different references, which Marlon followed up on last week, and we received very strong response from all three of the references about the quality of the work, and particularly the innovative ability to complete projects that require creative solutions, like removing very large trees from a pedestrian bridge in a river. So with all of that information, we are confident that this company can complete the work both on time, and they seem confident, having asked several questions during the bidding process, they seem confident that their bid is a good number, and so we would like to recommend National Concrete Cutting at the amount of $211,250 for the lead bridge debris cleanup, with a reminder that this is a partnership with the Game and Parks Commission and Lower Platte South. We expect 75% reimbursement from FEMA, and the remaining portion would be paid by Game and Parks per an interlocal, which we approved a few months ago. So there would not be an out-of-pocket cost for our district for this portion of the work. This is the first phase, and we expect additional phases, but not out-of-pocket cost for us for this work.
We can have a staff.
Move to accept staff recommendation.
Motion. Second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors? Director Teasman?
This coming spring, I'm assuming if we have additional trees, that's an add-on.
Yeah, so we would talk with Game and Parks, since they would be paying the local share. We would need to determine some type of a method for which debris was part of the flood emergency from March of 2019 and which additional debris was not part of the previous debris, so that after January 31st, if there was additional debris that came down, it's possible that per what we expect Game and Parks' request to change order that into the contract, we might be able to ask the contractor to continue work on additional debris that was not part of the original scope. Again, since Game and Parks is responsible for the normal operations and maintenance, we would expect that to be entirely their cost outside of the FEMA reimbursed portion. So we would take their recommendation as to whether or not they would like that additional debris removed as part of this contract. This is a pretty good price compared to what they've paid in the past, so we would expect that they would want to continue work to get all of it done at the same time, to avoid mobilization, but again, we would take their lead on whether or not they would like to continue work if that condition does come up.
Very likely to happen, so yeah.
It is, and so we will be coordinating at the pre-con meeting with both the other agencies and then determining how we'll verify which debris was there, as well as the methodology for tons of debris removed. So there's some coordination on the specifics with the contractor if it is awarded.
Thank you.
Just looking at this, 120 is the next closest bid, and we're at 85. That's a pretty big step.
Yes, and this was part of the reason why last month we did not recommend that the award be made, because the previous bid was even much significantly higher than anything we received this time. We are not totally clear as to why there is such a extreme variance between the prices that we received last bidding, this bidding, and previous awards. The low at $84.50 for the unit price there per ton is in line with the lower costs that had been seen from other contractors in, we believe, 2009, 11, and 16, when this work had been done before. Again, very large variance, you know, up to the highest bid four times the lowest bid. Very difficult to say why the bidding was so wide-ranging.
Is this a cost-plus contract?
This is a unit price for the tons of debris removed. The estimate is 2,500 tons. We will initially work with the contractor to come up with a method to measure dump truck loads removed from the site, probably weigh a few of them, and then use the volume times the 0.6 conversion factor, which was listed in the scope, which is attached here, to then document truck loads rather than weighing every single truck. 2,500 tons on a probably about a 10-ton load, you know, 250 trucks. It's going to take a while.
So,
I'm sorry?
It's a bit of a guessing by golly, isn't it?
Well, and we'll use, again, the size of the truck times that conversion factor the Game Parks has used in the past to make sure that we have a good estimate on the amount of debris removed.
Okay. So once you get past 2,500, what happens?
So our standard contracting allows up to 150%. Is that correct, Marlon? But
there is no limit.
To the total cost, but there is a limit to the per unit.
They bid it per ton.
So, for example, let's just say this was 80. You're saying it could go to 120.
The unit cost would remain the same. The number of units moved might increase, and if that exceeded more than 10% on top of the contract that we have, we would then need to come back for additional authorization for additional spending.
No.
No. I'm sorry, Molly.
It's a unit cost. If we go over 25% of the volume, there may be per ton. But
okay, 25% of the 2,500 tons. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes.
So 750. That means this thing could go to 3,250 tons, and at that point, they would have the right to renegotiate, or we do.
Both parties do, I think.
Okay, so it is, it's not a fixed.
The fact that it was quite low. But we see a lot of contractors that are really busy. You know, so they're going to throw it a bit, but make some good money. So I think that's why you see a lot of the high ones, because a lot of contractors are pretty busy right now. References. One was UNMC, one was Kiewit, and
Sigma Group.
Sigma Group. Anyway, they said this guy does what he said. He gets the job done on time. He always is. He said he found the right guy when I told him what he was going to do. Move off of a trail bridge on the Platte River, and he said, you got the right guy. This guy awesome with doing work. His main work is
hasn't missed yet.
I think this guy probably could peel the frosting off of a birthday cake. Which would be pretty easy.
That's what you want.
And then I talked to the guy, and he said, he personally knows the bridge. He and his kids have been out. Well, he's the president of
Prolic.
Yeah. But he said, I've seen contractor remove debris off the bridge last year. So he knows the work. He's been there. He knows what's going on. And so, I don't know. It's probably some of the best references I've ever heard.
Sounds like it. Thanks, Mom. Roll call.
Taser?
Yes. Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Hi. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
All Item number 8, review and recommendation on memorandum of agreement with USDA NRCS. Terry Schumann.
Okay, before us tonight, we have a memorandum of agreement with the United States Department of Agriculture and NRCS, or the Natural Resource Conservation Service. That agreement is attached in your packet. Also attached is the Appendix A, which is the acknowledgement of requirements for protection of privacy of personal and geospatial information relating to natural resource conservation programs. This agreement came about at the request of NRCS. They're requesting all NRDs here in Nebraska, but conservation districts throughout the United States to adopt, this agreement. They wanted it basically boilerplate nationwide. I know the NRD manager said we want to tweak a few things, so the agreement's tweaked a little bit for the 23 NRDs in the state of Nebraska, but the intent was to keep the agreement the same. Really, this agreement basically just reinforces what we've been doing for decades with NRCS. One of the things, if this is approved, that NRCS is saying they would like to, sometime in 2020, work with each individual NRD on what's called a working agreement, which will be more specific to the needs of the specific NRD. Pretty standard agreement. Brent's reviewed it. So I guess the staff recommendation is to approve the agreement so the general manager can authorize it and it'll get signed and approved. Before we take any questions, I would like to note that we do have someone here with NRCS, Andy Bonacamp. He will be starting as the district conservationist for the NRD on December 23rd. So we welcome him aboard.
Thanks a lot, Terry. Anyone else want to speak to the item? Or you just it? We can have a staff recommendation.
So this. Move.
Second.
Second. Did anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors?
Back, what was it? Thank you, sir. What was exactly the clarification for the 23?
I guess I would have to go back and look at the redlined version to remember that, to be honest with you, Mr. Grunewald, but it was...
There were several. The NRD, all 23 NRDs reviewed the agreement and as provided by USDA NRCS, so there was numerous little changes, but the USDA and the NRCS agreed to those, and This is the final document. So there was a number of them. They weren't significant. I think this is kind of an effort by USDA to make sure all of these conservation districts have formal agreements, and they were very minor. And all 23 NRDs agreed and are going through the process of approving.
Just give me an example of a minor.
I don't have them in front of me, and if you have a redline version, Terry, fine. We can send you. You have a copy of the agreement, and they weren't major.
And a lot of it was just instead of conservation district, natural resource district.
Right. Yeah.
Those are easy ones. That's what I'm asking.
Yeah. That's
Birdsmith.
That. Yeah. So.
Any other questions?
I had one quick one. Andy, will you be presenting like Neil Jensen did to our board?
Yes, I will. Yeah.
That's the new Neil.
I think Thursday night I'll be here.
All right, wonderful. Looking forward to it.
Thanks.
Director Thomas, do you have a question?
One of the examples is no other states, this is the same memo, no other states had NRDs. So there was a
section. I understand completely. If it's as simple as that,
don't worry about it.
Okay.
Roll call.
Bradley?
Yes.
Jack?
Yes.
Kavinsky?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Aye. Thanks a lot, Mark. Item number 9, review and recommendation on potential violation of district erosion and sediment control rules and regulations. Justin Roback.
How you doing?
Oh, not too bad.
All right. Make sure this thing's working here. All right. So on November 21st of this year, we received formal complaints from Barrett Home on behalf of Mark Ondrachek and Rod Shear. And I guess it'd probably be better to start with a map and then I can kind of go back into the story. So originally I was contacted by Mr. Ondrachek, it was probably a year and a half ago now, about this time. And he had been receiving some excessive sediment on his property for a lot of years. From my understanding, it's in the range of 15 years this has been happening. So he's talked with numerous agencies and people along the way trying to find out who can help him with this resolution. So I said, well, I'd like to think it fell on the right desk here about a year ago. So we're still working through some things out here. But basically, the background is, if you see this farm here, this is the Michael Cornwell farm right here, and this is the area of concern. Mr. Ondrachek's house is here, and Mr. Shear's house is here. And there's two different valleys, basically, that were having excessive sediment damage. And when we went out there originally a year and a half ago, there was no terraces, deeply incised ditches, up and down the hill farming, pretty much about the worst conditions for farming that you could. It's really, really tough soil types over there. As you get east of 133, and it's kind of hard to see, but basically, the Blair Airport is right down here. So this is Highway 133, and just to give you a rough location of where it's at. So like I said, the soil types, they're a little difficult in this area. So we met with Mr. Cornwell, come up with a conservation plan, worked with Andy, kind of the same thing we talked about here a couple months ago, where you got to get below a certain soil loss criteria. So Andy ran his numbers, and with no-till farming, contour farming, and terracing, to address the sheet and rail and ephemeral gullies would get him below his soil loss criteria level. So we worked with Michael, developed that plan, and actually constructed the terraces here this last spring. Well, with the factors of a lot of different conditions, I think with when you talk soil types, the rainfall events we've had this year, and a lot of other things led to some issues that we have continued onto this year. So now they filed the formal complaint again this year, and we're moving forward with this process as we go. You want to go to the next picture, Joe? Down the way here. Maybe zoom out just a little. Oh, there we go. That'll work, actually. So this is actually the farm here. Here's the two homes I was speaking of. This is actually the terraces that we built in the field. This is the top terrace comes around here on the caps of the hill. Then we have a second terrace down below here and a second terrace here. We weren't able to put any kind of structure measure across here because there's actually a really large nose that kind of comes out. So you'd have to wrap the terrace like this, and it just doesn't work with farming. So if you wonder why there's a kind of a gap in between those two terraces, if you want to just keep going down the pictures. This just kind of shows what I was talking about there. So you can see where, they were getting a lot of ditches right here, 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 and all the way up here. So we, like I said, we constructed those in the spring, and I think it gets into the pictures. We can kind of go through those to show. These pictures were submitted by Mr. Ondrachek. He did a very good job of documenting these things. Go ahead, keep going along, Bill. So this is one of the first pictures I ever saw. As you can see, there's a lot of, and when we talk about, the sediment complaints, obviously Mark and Mr. Shear, they understand that, you have to deal with the water at some point. Now here, this is a little bit excessive in the fact that his ditch has become so silted in over the years that the water is now diverted towards his house. And if you keep going along in the pictures, all of that used to run along the east side of the outbuilding, and you can see the sediment. This is the first time I still met, 2018. You can see that the sediment and debris is reaching all the way out to the roadside, well in front of Mr. Ondrachek's house. And I believe that this is this year, if you go down. Okay, so unfortunately, with what we did out there after reviewing this fall, has failed. And the pictures that he notes here on September 19th, and I spoke with him earlier in the spring after we first built the terraces, and he said he was still seeing a little bit of sediment. And I said, well, that might be normal. There's no soil structure, there's no crop residue, there's no nothing out there. He's like, okay. And then he calls me in September. He's like, I got a really bad problem. And as you can see, he's almost worse maybe than what it was the first time. You know, the terraces after field review this fall have failed. And if you keep going down through the pictures, there was multiple blowouts in the terraces. And we were kind of working with the NRCS and trying to determine what could be the cause of that. You know, obviously it's really hard to pinpoint it, but the one thing we were able to figure out was that actually on September 19th, the Blair Airport recorded 6.7 inches of rain. And I think that was the day the terraces failed. That's our best. That's a speculation. That's the best thing we could come up with, though. And if you keep going, I think the very last, those pictures I sent you today, Bill, are they in there? So I was able to get out in the field here post-harvest. It's been a little challenging because harvest was pretty slow. So here's the terraces. This is the top terrace above Mr. Andrzejczyk's house. You can see complete failure around the riser. I mean, huge gashes down in the terrace. It's kind of a mess out there right now. And so speaking with Andy and with the current state of where this is at, he's still not meeting his compliance with soil loss. So that's where, you know, as a staff, from what we see out there and what's currently happening, he's still in violation of the sediment control. And that's up to you guys to determine. That's what you guys vote on. So that's kind of the gist of the background. So basically, the staff recommendation is Mr. Cornrow rebuild his terraces back to adequate design height. So that's cleaning out the channels, you know, redoing around the risers, repairing those holes in the terraces, and that will get him to his soil loss criteria, get him down below T, and that's per the NRCS. Obviously, all that direction comes from the NRCS. We are just kind of the administrators of the program. So really, that's the only requirement that Mr. Cornwell will have is repairing those terraces to adequate height. Now, that being said, we are trying to work with them and look at some additional things that are voluntary. You know, obviously this gets into their soil loss criteria, but we're looking at some CRP options, maybe some permanent vegetative options like alfalfa or maybe some brome grass, something that they get hay because they have cattle operations. The CRP program actually came out this week, but they don't have an actual sign-up going right now. I spoke with the gal over in the FSA. She was still running through all the scenarios and getting the rental rates. So we're gonna propose some of those things to Mr. Cornwell, but those are all voluntary. So, but we want to see some, we would love to see some additional measures out there, but this gets him to his requires. Yep.
We could have a recommendation on this item.
Second.
Motion and second. Anyone in the public who wish to speak to the item?
Good evening. My name is Jeremy Hollenbeek. I'm from the Baird Home Firm, and we represent the Shears and the Andrzejczyks. Both Mr. Shear and Mr. Andrzejczyk here, and would like to speak to you guys this evening, and I'm just going to set the stage. Really what we wanted to emphasize, and there was some concern based upon Mr. Novak's memorandum. I think he provided a little more color just now, but it sure seemed from the memorandum that the explanation was there was a problem before measures were implemented that corrected the problem, and then heavy rains, in particular in September, caused the terraces to fail, and you guys just need to order additional or the same measures as before, where I think even Mr. Novak's presentation just now admitted that conditions were very bad from the get-go, and that the terraces that were put up weren't sufficient, even from, you know, before that they failed. So we urge the subcommittee to please issue more comprehensive measures. We agree with the staff recommendation, obviously, but just repairing the terraces to what they were is not gonna resolve the problem, in our view. And I would like to now just, and we'll have we'll hear Mr. Shear and Mr. Andrzejczyk sort of fill in that.
Sure.
Good evening. My name is Mark Andrasek. This is Rod Shear.
Nice to meet you.
We're neighbors in the Eagle View subdivision that have the problem. The first thing I'd like to point out is in the memorandum that was handed out that it says that on September 19th that the Valera Airport got 6.7 inches of rain. We did a little checking last night, and the Valera Airport is not a weather site that's reported by the National Weather Service, but there is one about a mile and a half to the northeast of us that is an official weather station. And that day, instead of 6.7 inches of rain that was on this report, it was reported that, if I could find this here, 3.62 inches, not the 6.7 inches, fell at that official station. The total rainfall for the month of September of 2019 was 6.07 inches, which is less than the 6.7 that the memorandum says fell on that one day. So it was considerably less. I'm not arguing the point that the terraces failed, but it wasn't because it was the terraces are rated for 4.26 inches of rainfall in a 24-hour period. At no time during the whole summer did we receive 4.26 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. So the terraces failed, but they didn't fail because the rainfall amount was more than what the terraces were built for. So that's the first thing. When we originally did this, Rod and I sent a letter to Mr. Cornwell asking to meet with us so we could work something out. We sent a letter on June 22nd of 2018. We sent one certified. We sent one regular mail. He picked up the certified mail, and we got the return receipt on that. We never got a response. So on the 15th of July, we sent a follow-up letter saying, hey, you know, we sent you this letter, blah, blah, blah. We'd like to get together. We need to work this out somehow. So on a letter dated 7/24 that we received on 7/27, I received a small note from Mr. Michael Cornwell, who owns the property. Dear Mr. Andrasek, I am sorry for your feelings. Your consideration is greatly appreciated. Thank you. Very truly yours in kind, Michael Cornwell. I guess that was Mr. Cornwell's idea of trying to work things out with us. So that's when we were forced to go and file the original complaint that led up to everything that we talked about there. I had talked to Todd Cornwell a couple of years prior to that, who is Michael's father. They had the farming operation together. He was on the tractor. At that time, I'm retired now, but at that time I was working, so he's always in the field during the day, and I was working, so I wasn't around. For some reason, he must have been out there on a Saturday. I was out in my yard cleaning up some debris that had come down from a couple days before, and I seen the tractor going by. So I run up the hill, and I motioned for him to come over, and he got out of the tractor. And I said, hey, and I said, I want to show you what I'm up against here. I'm show you what I got coming off your property. So he come off the tractor, come on my property, walk down and seen all the debris that was laying there. And it was considerably less than what I've got now. And he says, yeah, man, I feel your pain. And he turned around and walked away and got on his tractor and drove off. So this is what we're dealing with. The Cornwells have not been overly accommodating towards us. And the NRD has tried to set up meetings between all of us. Neither Todd nor Michael Cornwell has agreed to meet with us and the NRD. They've met with the NRD, but not with Rod and I. So that's kind of what we're up against here. Originally, after the terraces were put in April, I noticed a little silt coming down, and Justin had given us a site plan that they were planning on. They put the terraces in that you've seen on the map. There was also a couple of silt dams that run along the property line, the north property line for Rod and I, and the south property line for the Cornwells. There were supposed to be two silt dams, one on my side of the hill and one on Rod's side of the hill. Our properties are like this. It goes up like this, so there's a funnel on either side, one funnel to my yard, one funnel to Rod's yard. So Originally, there were supposed to be a couple of silt dams in there, and after they got done, the silt dams weren't implemented. So I called Justin. I got Justin on speed dial now, so and told him that the silt dams weren't in place, and he says, well, it was a decision that there might have been overkill with the silt dams, so they decided not to do it. So a week or two later, it rained. I get all the silt down, so I sent Justin a text saying, hey, evidently the silt dams weren't overkill. I got quite a mess going on here. Why don't you call me? And he did call, and that's when he explained that, well, we're going to have, because the land's been tore up and there's no root structure, you know, and just like Justin said, he told me all that, and I said, well, okay. I mean, I've got a mess here. I said, how long will it take? He says, it may take a couple, 3 months for this to all settle out. And it's like, not what I wanted to hear, but okay, this is what we have to deal with. So, every time it rains, it gets worse and worse, and I mean exponentially worse. All of the swales that I had in place to handle the water, because like Justin said, we know we have to handle the water, not a problem. The swales that I put in, the swales that Rod had put in when we built the houses, all handled the water for quite a few years until the silt filled them in. Now it pushes the water everywhere. We can't control anything. I've got, you've seen the pictures, the mud around my shed is, I can't mow if it rains. I can't mow for days if it rains. I've got mud coming in my shed. I've got mud coming in my garage. The swale behind my house to handle any overflow, it was just kind of an emergency type deal that I put in, is getting filled up. It's pushing the water and the mud up towards my house. It's a mess. And if something would happen and I would have to sell that property in the next year, I couldn't sell it. Nobody in their right mind would come in and look at the mud that I've got laying there and want to buy my property. So that's what I'm up against. Rod?
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, board members, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to come speak. My name is Rod Shear. I am the neighbor to Mark Andrusek. I live at 3510 Golden Eagle Circle, the property that's listed there. So thank you once again for giving us the opportunity to speak. I do want to say that we do appreciate the efforts that everybody is trying to make. We've been trying to, you know, we kind of seek some advice, and they said, try to work it out. Try to work it out as good neighbors as we've been. Obviously, I'm not going to reiterate Mark's tale of the woes, but so we're up to this point. So I think from my perspective, water's fine. Just like you guys, I almost chuckled when you guys were talking about filling the rivers. I'm like, I'm fine with that water coming down. I have no problem with it. It needs to go. It needs to go over to the rivers and whatever. It's the debris and sediments. And it really was okay for quite a number of years. It's last year, I think, as Justin said, with the farming practices that were in place, all of a sudden the debris and sediment just was exponential. I don't think the pictures, would I be okay in providing some material? Is that okay? Okay. I only have a couple. I am sorry. I did not know. Maybe you can hand out. So this is the back part of my neighborhood. I have two sets, so you guys can see. And there's some dated pictures there that go on from last year when the major event occurs, and then has it changed? And so after the terraces were put in, I mean, after the year, I waited all summer, and it was mud, and every year I have pictures, and so it was mud every year. So when the terraces and stuff were put in, I mean, by that time, grass had grown and weeds. That's really weed that grows up in that area. Before that first picture, that was lush grass, fresh mulch around all of my fruit trees, and now it's like that, okay? So after that 529 picture, that was after the terraces been built, the first heavy rain of 2019. The 6-3 picture is like 4 days later. Both of those were like 2 inches on one and like a half an inch of rain on the next picture. And it keeps progressing into 2019. So it's my feeling that the initial measures that were put in place were not sufficient, right? They helped a little bit, as you saw, but they were not sufficient. If they failed, and I think they failed worse on Mark's side than mine, sure, that caused it to give back to exponential problems again. But even before that, I was getting damage, continued damage. And From my quality of life and my family's quality, I've got an 8-year-old boy that for the first year cannot use his playground last year because it was full of mud. That pea gravel turned to concrete. This year he cannot use it because it continues to be damaged. And now we're talking about waiting until next year to even maybe do something to stop the damage before I can even prepare the damage. So I'm going to get 3 years of prime time of his life that he won't get to use this playground. And I'm with Mark. I've got mower damage. I can't mow in my big chunk of my lot. The water's fine. We've controlled it. I'm just asking so maybe that we can stop this damage once and for all. Because I've 3 years of that'll be coming on almost, you know, 3 summers of this by the time we get this corrected. So other than that, we do look forward to continue to work with you, and we're obviously, we've been living this long with it. We're very considerate of everybody's time and efforts that they're made. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to speak to the item? Director's there?
Conley, Justin, so for the director's benefit, I've been up there and walked Mr. Andersek's, am I saying that correctly, land, and it's a mess. It's a mess. You had some stuff buried that was at one time 3-4 feet above the earth and now is essentially just completely silted in. What's the best possible thing we can do? Because I can see rebuilding the terraces, all that land's going to be reworked. We're going to get flushed again, and then it's going to come right back down. So what's the best possible scenario here? We'll okay, and let me ask a second question. Will the, is it Cornwall?
Yes.
Have you talked to them? Will they entertain alfalfa or just something besides cutting that up again?
I think we've always Andy, the RRC, or soon to be new DC, RCS develops all those conservation. So further recommendations, it was just terraces, but I was like, hey, maybe we can. Have we done that this year with all the failure of terraces? Just try it.
Brett, and if I'm correct, we can only require what practices will get them below the statutory limit. We cannot require anything more than what would, we can ask them to, but we can't make them do anything more than what we require to get below the 5 tons.
Correct. Okay. And just for clarification for tonight, the motion or the staff recommendation for you. That being said, the extra measures. Probably influence them, or at least try.
Like a recipe to happen again and again until we take some extraordinary measures.
And Andy can speak about farm compliance.
Don't sit down, Justin.
Thank you, sir.
When the terraces were put in April, right?
Yes.
Your opinion, you brought up the root structures and development. We've been around this a long time. You did have enough time to really set up soil structure. 5 months, 2 months is what I'm seeing here. Schedule to expect. Vigorous and robust as soil biology is,
Well, and I will say that some of the have no grass cover on the terraces.
Put in the terraces, they met the criteria. So did that earlier about our responsibility, did we hit that when he dropped below the
criteria?
So at that point, he had done everything we would could require of it. So now where do we stand on that?
The calculations show that it's
back above now.
Thank you. I got a couple questions. I met with these guys last month as well and shared Kevin's sentiments on that. It's a mess. So you guys are represented by council. The way I understand it, I'm certainly new to this, but is there's a legal obligation by the NRD that we meet, right, John? Or Brent?
By like, statute, we have, these are the statutory guidelines we're processing.
Okay. So
the NRD is supposed to enforce the rule.
Right. Okay, so the recommendation we vote on is that they're a probable violation.
Correct.
That's what we're voting on.
Right.
So with these gentlemen here, what's the time frame for any involvement that we have? Obviously, if it rains, you guys are still dealing with the challenges that you've brought before us with the pictures, and I saw it with my own eyes, and I apologize to Director Japp because I invaded his district without notifying him ahead of time. But
and I appreciate the fact that Ted come out. I called him one evening. And
I called him, so I'm covered. That's a rookie mistake. But
he was out the next morning after I called, and I appreciate it. So
well, so what's the time frame we're looking at, Justin, on when this complaint proceeds, whatever action we take? What's the separate part that you guys maybe don't have to go into that, but what's the time frame we're looking at?
Well, this time of year is difficult, obviously. Now it's getting in post-harvest prior to getting with these people. My goal is to hopefully have some plans to bring to you. Solid plan of what we're going to complete. Hoping to have that. So.
And you worked the delicate. Oh, go ahead, Brent.
Just to follow up on Justin's point, that plan, if the Cornwalls violation, there's different procedures. To have that plan prepared, we need to have that conversation, and we will have an indication in the Cornwalls that they are willing to. Approval of the plan or the presentation of the plan.
Well, and I know you commented in the past when you were here before that maybe I'm reading this wrong, but you were hopeful that the Cornwell crew will kind of start moving to get this resolved. Is that what your sense is? I know you're working hard on this.
Yeah. They've been receptive to everything we've prior to all this, so we've known.
My OPBD claims job, I walked that fine line that you're walking to try to get this thing together. So I wish you guys luck in that, because
yeah,
I know in seeing this in person, it's
yeah,
it's a challenging deal you're handling. So,
well, I think one thing you haven't brought up to note in regard to the Michael Cornwell and the we did meet with the Cornwells and their contractor last Friday, and their contractor, I mean, we're kind of up against it here with weather, but if it doesn't freeze up, he may try to get in there and get that fixed. I mean, the next week or so. Sure. But we strongly encourage that, hey, if you can get this done, and
mitigate future issues.
Well, it's going to be helpful. Because sure. The way it is now, it's not functioning. It's causing more problems than if they weren't.
Agree with that.
Yeah. You know, yeah. So it needs to get fixed, and we're encouraging to get it fixed ASAP. But
fine line, I got it.
Thanks. Thank you, Jack.
Just one other thing. I directed over this direction. You mentioned a certain contractor. I had an opportunity to talk to, I believe, that same certain contractor. He had mentioned that the Lower Elkhorn NRD has a program of cover crop that pays up to $250 an acre. I don't know if that's accurate or not. Far more than anything that we have. And he said they get a much better response on those buffer barrier areas, like between the fields and your type of property. If you get a more permanent solution there that would pay the farmer more, like an alfalfa brome type barrier on a longer term basis, and you just leave it as a cover crop like that, and you don't take, you know, you don't try and plant corn in there, you leave it as a hard cover crop, and then it absorbs an awful lot of that silt coming down the hill, and it also prevents those gullies from forming in there. And so if we could, I guess it's just throwing something out here for the board to consider very soon, that maybe we should look at something like that also to bring that about for farmers to have that as an option also, so that we stop having this type of problem come before the board. Whatever type of climate, we're going to see more and more of that. And that might be something that would be very, very good to have available to them.
Can I respond to that?
You certainly can.
I guess I'm not quite clear the program you're talking
That's
about.
That's what he had said.
The contractor and I discussed a program which is called Landsman Conservation, which we have.
Right, but he said we don't pay enough compared to them.
Hear me
so
out.
So nobody's doing it. Okay.
Hear me out. It's for people to, or landowners to give them an incentive to plant a small crop, row crop, basically like oats, maybe wheat, something like that. In the spring, harvest them, you know, June, July, and then do the construction work in the summer. We do have a lands for conservation program. It's in the policy manual. It's policy 1712. Basically, we upped that back in 2012. It was $50 an acre. We went to $100 an acre. There isn't a lot of interest because $100 an acre isn't a big thing. The Lower Elkhorn, they have $250. It's something we've discussed internally. Well, should we consider, you know, increasing that? And certainly we could, and ultimately it'd be a board decision. You know, but it's just, it becomes, with tax dollars, how much do you keep throwing out there? That's the decision you guys make. So it's certainly something we can entertain, and that's probably more specifically geared toward other erosion complaint that we had here a couple months ago, because that's what they're considering is doing that route, but that's something the board is interested. We can explore that more. That's really what that program is.
Right, I understand.
It's for construction, not like after the fact.
Director Weiss, I have done what you're talking about with the brome. I had an issue at my horse barn, and it was running, taking all the waterfall off the hill, coming down. It was channeling down to like a little river-type trough, and going down into Dweeble Creek. And what I did was we went ahead and we regraded it. Took a couple of times to do it. We put up some berms, but what we did a combination. Brome's gonna work a lot, don't do alfalfa. Alfalfa's not dense enough, we tried that, because when you cut alfalfa or you look at the alfalfa at the ground, you still see ground around it, because you're only dropping so many seeds a square foot. But when you do the brome's gonna cover just like your yard. It'll cover the whole thing. And yes, it will catch. It's catching all of what I've got, but I had to do probably 500 feet is what I did all the way across. I recontoured it. And here's something else that, you know, I don't know what exactly. I may have to go look at that, the dimensions of that field. But it'll take care of a lot of the sediment. You'll get the sediment out, and it'll catch all the way through. Don't worry about that. Brome's going to come back. It'll come right back. But here's the thing. If you get all this water coming down, I don't know if you're going to be able to catch all that water. If you have just a huge downpour, you'll catch the sediment, but you're not going to catch them. You'll catch 70% of the water, 60%, but you're not going to catch all of it when it comes down at once.
Can I say something to that? When Rod and I both built our properties, built our houses, we had the property graded out. We had swales, ditches, whatever you want to call them, to control that water. Because obviously, when we each bought our lot, you could see the water was coming down. We can control the water. We can, I mean, without the silt filling in the swales and ditches and everything that we put in place, we can control the water. It's not an issue. Neither one of us care about the water. But it's the sediment filling up the ditches to control the water. Once they get full, then we're screwed.
Well, if you go back and you redo the terrace, I really think you might throw another drain tile or two in your terrace. You know, don't be bashful how many you put in there. You know, just put three, four. You know, a lot of farmers will do one. They go around the corner and do one. Put two or three in there. It's not gonna hurt nothing. It'll get rid of your water. But if you can get that water knocked down, you know, and get rid of the water, and you do some planting and some other stuff, I think you'll get rid of a lot of that mess. Be patient. You know, this is not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a year or two to get your stand up, you know, and the main thing, try to figure out how to get it for now directed.
And well, life's a learning experience when it comes to that. It seems like that's a drier period. But also, that also does is you put a small grain out there to start. When they construct those terraces. That's one scenario we're looking at.
Well, and if you do the timing just right and you're ready to go, they've got seed now. They got this faster growing seed. And if you can hit your timing right, you can still go in there and put your wheat or your rye, whatever you want to put in there. Go ahead and harvest it. Just get your timing down. You can harvest it because if you hustle, you know, and you get it done, you still got time. You can probably put a one crop in there, but it's all timing. And Ben's got the best of both worlds. You got two crops.
I think we got that discussion. Do we know where we're going the next one, Justin?
As far as the board direction, you mean? Yeah, the recommendation is.
Okay. We got that as a roll call.
Jeff?
Yes.
Yes.
Caesar?
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Aye. We appreciate you coming down.
Thank you very much.
Direction that we're going to go in the next month. Thank you. Item number 10, review and recommendation on NRD historical remains discovery policy. Director Larry Bradley.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, fellow directors, and certainly the subcommittee tonight. I would hope that you'd see fit to perhaps pass what I'm trying to implement into the policy, approve, I should say. Just simple two sentences. And our legal representation helped devise these two sentences. And I'll read them off here. If any NRD personnel or its contractors discover any previously unknown historic, archaeological, or paleontological remains while conducting district activities, they are to immediately notify the NRD general manager or assistant general manager of what they have found and its location. Required federal, state, or tribal coordination will be initiated to determine the appropriate course of action. example, if the remains warrant recovery effort and or historic designation. Now, as I was, spoke with General Manager Winkler, and he can speak for himself as well, that this is something that sort of the district already has in place, and there's certain, you know, federal rules and there's some state law, but this would be good policy to have for the Papio, Missouri NRD, and I definitely think it would be to prevent any great embarrassment to the NRD for any type of project that may, you know, be come down the road. Now, I know it's been said that we really don't do any big projects on the Native American reservations within our boundaries, our jurisdiction. However, I think it'd be very good ambassadorship to, you know, let, for the tribes to know that we, you know, think about them and keep them in mind for a lot of the work that we do. And in case in the future, you can never say never if there's anything that we might have to be called upon to do in the Native American reservation, certainly if, something like the Great Flood of March 2019, you never know when we may be called such. I did present to each member, and I might didn't have enough, and if I short a member or two of this full board, a copy of my book that I had written, which is my work that I'd done as a dissertation, and it deals with fossils in Native American land. 40s onward, and I've been also, and I am a current member of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, which is the international governing body of all paleontological resources worldwide. For some time there, I'm not right now, but I've been on the Government Affairs Committee for the SVP, talked about these issues and worked with these issues. My particular work is, you know, not to pat my back here, but it's an original contribution to science, and it's a sort of a who, what, and where. It will be highlighted, if just a side note, on PBS this summer. There's a three-part series, and I was interviewed by PBS, Chicago Field Museum, but PBS broadcasted in a three-part series in the summer, and I'll probably be mostly in part three. My work, but that's just sort of for your perusal for Thursday night when it comes before the full board to vote on this. I just would hope you'd see fit that this would be a goodwill gesture, and I think it's one of those feel good, and I know we're a nonpartisan board, but in today's age, a good, you know, from the right and from the left to come together on something that definitely field any questions or concerns that directors have. Thank you for being so patient, Mr. Chairman. Yes, that is my motion.
I'll second it.
Director Bradley, what happens now if a contractor stumbles upon a dinosaur or some kind of artifact that appears to be important?
If he finds a dinosaur in the state of Nebraska, which he probably wouldn't, but a plesiosaur or mosasaur, something from the Cretaceous.
All right, some kind of cool bone.
Cool bone. What did he say?
Mammoth or a smilodon, saber-tooth, but refer to general manager.
So the current process is if we have to gain a permit, like a 404 permit, there's a section in that permit that indicates, similar to what this states, that we have to notify the Corps and then they go through their process. So I think standard operating procedure of the district, if it's our project, it's maybe not a 404. Say the rural water guys are installing a main or somebody's planting a tree or whatever, our project. And if a remain or some historical significant remnant was found, they would obviously contact me or Marlin, and we would go through the process of contacting the proper authorities. All this really does is it puts in policy what everybody would do anyway. And also, I think would be significant is we would put this as a condition of our contracts with a contractor. So any vendor that we contract with, this would be stated in that contract,
if in fact they find something per this policy, then they have a recourse, a process to follow. So we're doing it already. It's formalizing.
Okay. Thank you.
Director Thompson.
Dr. Bradley. I'm going to call you doctor here. I'm looking at the policy manual, and it looks like there's some sections in like 17.14, district program reserve, and some of those have been reserved like forever, or Gene. So I guess my question, it's got to be plugged in somewhere.
Yeah, we'll plug it in. We'll find a spot.
Assuming it gets out of committee.
Sure. I talked to Larry, and I think the first part is, you know, if it gets approved, we'll find a home for it. But and then it will also be submitted into contracts as well as a condition.
Roll call.
Yes.
Yes.
Bradley? Yes.
Aye. And at long last, that concludes my last.
Anybody have to take a break?
It's an after-effective pay.
Thanks.
I got to use the latrine.
Okay, 5 minutes.
Everybody,
5 minutes. Time is 8:25. We'll call the FEL subcommittee to order.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Notification, the Open Meeting Act is posted out in the on the door and in the back of the room with that quorum call.
Bradley?
Here.
Bradley?
Here.
McCormick?
Here.
Weiss?
Here.
And Chairperson?
Here. Adoption of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Roll call.
Bradley?
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
Weiss? Yes.
Bradley?
Aye.
And Chairperson?
Yes. Proof of publication of notice meeting, I have it before me. Moving on to item 6, review and recommendation of fiscal year 2019 audit, Kerry Fly and Josh Truitt, Burgundy KDV, I'm sorry. Can't read tonight. Good evening, folks.
Good evening, tonight we have Josh Truitt from Burgundy KDV to give an overview of the fiscal year 19 audit and answer any questions you might have about the report. So, Josh.
Sure. Thank you for having us here. We appreciate the opportunity to work with you all, and want to thank everybody at the NRD and the district that's helped us with the audit and put things together. Special thanks to Carrie for putting all the work papers together and all that. She puts a lot of work and effort together to get this put together for us, and we appreciate all the work she's done for us. And such. To my understanding, everybody's had a chance to at least kind of finger through the financial statements and take a look at it. They were published this last week or so. The important information we kind of put on a summary of audit results and reports, which basically kind of gives a breakdown of everything that we kind of thought was important that you guys really want to hone in on and such. The first part there is we issued a unmodified opinion on page 1 and 2. This report was issued on December 4th. Basically, that says that our opinion is that the financial statements are fairly presented in all material respects. It's the highest assurance that we can give for an audit, so an unmodified report is a very good thing. So we also have to report on compliance and internal control over financial reporting in accordance with government auditing standards. And through there, we found no deficiencies that are required to be reported to you. There were no material matters of non-compliance that need to be reported. And the one thing that we did find going through the audit was that there was the district overexpended a couple of its funds on the proprietary funds. Those are the water funds that you have. Just a little bit non-compliance there, but it's not material to the financial statements. It's not required to be reported. But we still want to bring it to your attention that you did overexpend your budget just a little bit. As part of the audit, we looked at the federal awards to see if you were required to do a single audit. There was no single audit required. You were under the $750,000 requirement for that, so no single audit was performed. We did issue a governance letter to the board, and the governance letter basically goes through and reports all our findings and that we have, and lets you know that everything we found was in good order. We did one adjustment to the financial statements for the modified accrual and putting the debt and the land acquisition on the financial statements, and then we reversed it with another entry after that. And we also proposed three other entries that we found that were immaterial individually and combined were immaterial to the financial statements, and we did not post those. Management did not believe they were material, and we concur that they were not material. And those were also attached to the governance letter that was published. Some observations, recommendations that we came across. Every year we look at internal controls, and every year the district is getting better and improving their controls and taking a very proactive approach to making sure that they're getting enough segregation of duties and things put together. We always want to encourage more segregation of duties if possible. Unfortunately, not every district has the funds available to hire more staff and things of that nature to get segregation of duties, but this district does a really good job with its segregation of duties, and it also has a lot of monitoring controls in place to help mitigate any risk that could be there if there was any lack of segregation of duties. Another thing we kind of recommend is on the management discussion analysis, we always recommend putting more data in there. That's the opportunity for the NRD to really communicate to its citizens what's going on in the NRD, what's happening, what's coming up, what's going forward. We always like to recommend putting more and more information in there just for the citizens to know what's going on. That's one of the recommendations we come across. And the next book note on there is the overspending on the budgets for those two proprietary funds. Financial highlights. We had an overall net position decrease of about $17.5 million. This is significantly affected by the fact that we gave away $39 million of assets when we completed the dams. That's why you're having a negative net position or decrease in net position. Your net investment capital assets decreased by $22.2 million. And that's calculated by capital assets less accumulated depreciation and any outstanding debt against it. And again, that decrease is really driven by that $39 million that you gave away to the city of Omaha. Your long-term debt, that decreased roughly about $3 million or so. You had $62 million of debt this year compared to $65 million the previous year. We have a debt-to-tax valuation decrease of 10%, and the calculation we kind of provided that to you is the long-term debt divided by the tax valuation that's used for the calculation of property taxes and such. And essentially, that ratio is kind of important because when it decreases, it shows that you have the ability to probably have more debt or take on more debt, so you're paying down your debt. It's always a good thing to pay down your debt. Fund balance for the general fund, it increased 3.9 up to $36 million. That's a very good positive sign. Shows that you got a very good operating income going on in that regards. And essentially the water funds also increased $163,000. So very positive in that regard. Everything looked like it was in a positive light there. So. Any questions, comments, concerns, anything about the reports, anything in the financials that you'd like to highlight and go over? I know I went through a lot of things real quick. I'm nervous.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have you recommend the district expand its management discussion and analysis section of the audit report, and I, not to throw other local government entities under the bus, but I thought we were one of the best, and I don't know if you audit other besides the NRDs, but John, you might have said before that we've put a lot out there, but yet
right.
still, compared to other ones, I guess, we compare ourselves to ourselves, and that's, you know, do our best. Recommendations, I guess, in, you know, what out there.
Well, yeah, and we've every year we work with the auditing firm of Cary to try to expand that, and we're trying to put more in there, and I think they'll always come back and say you can do more.
Right.
And so it's one of those things you continually try to improve and just get as much information as you can for the public to understand. Especially the NRDs are very unique, so it's not like a city or county. It's one of the most unique, obviously, entities that you audit.
Yep.
From our discussion. And so yep. It's always just trying to find that balance of how much do you expend to get that information out. So that's what we're doing. We do that every year, though. So.
Yeah. It's just one of those recommendations. We always recommend to give more information to the public. The public likes having information, and putting more in there gives more clarity to the public.
Took me 10 years to get Cary into her own locked room, but now she's in there. So we checked that off the list. So.
It sounds to me that Cary needs to be congratulated and his staff on an excellent report.
I agree.
And with that, I'd ask for a motion with acceptance of recommendation.
Motion.
Second. Comments from the audience? Non-existent. Oh, I'm sorry.
I just had one question. Just net unassigned fund balance.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
That is basically unrestricted, unassigned funds that hasn't been designated for anything yet. It's just unassigned, and that's on page 12 under the fund balances. You have the unassigned balance of $22 million there. Nothing's been directed for it. It's not been...
It's not earmarked.
Not exactly. It's unassigned. And we give a description of the definitions of what the fund balances are under the note 24. Yeah. The fund balance is a residual classification of the general fund. It includes all spendable amounts not contained in any other classification. I mean, it hasn't been designated yet for anything.
It's roughly what we have to start the next budget year.
Thank you.
This money that Director McCormick was talking about, yeah, it is, you know, $22.7 million. So it's unassigned, and it's just kind of sitting there. Is this borrowed money? What is this money? Why would we have that much money sitting there? Just for whatever.
That entire. It would be our ending cash, our other current, our current liability for the modified accrual basis.
It's right. Not assigned because it hasn't been budgeted yet.
Okay,
when
but
you budget, then you assign it.
Where did this money come from?
It's fees that have been paid by the development community from the partnership. It's money that's been paid up front by. Like City of Omaha, City of Bellevue, Sarpy County for the levies that hasn't been expended. It may be grant funds from the state that haven't been expended. It's the watershed from the Sarpy County where those like Google and Facebook have paid $800,000 each for something that sits in there. So there, it's assigned to programs and projects. It's just and it gets assigned when you do your budget. So. So it's not just laying out there with no home. It's just how they have to report it.
Yeah, it's the fund balance.
You just basically call it unassigned.
Right. It's an accumulation from over the years of things that you know, cash and investments and taxes receivable and that haven't been assigned to a specific project and been spent yet.
It's real water funding.
Okay, then I've got one more question here then. It says the fund balance for the general fund, same thing, it increased by $3.9 million to $36.5 million. Mm-hmm. What's considered, what's in that general fund?
General fund is a lot of your general activities within the NRD. That's pretty much all your governmental activities that you're involved in. That's all included in the general fund. On page 14, you'll see the general fund activities that's in there. Your general administration, your flood prevention, your erosion control, forestry, wildlife, water quality, recreation. These are basically your operations is what's going through the general fund there.
Okay. Now remember, the audit is review of the past year.
Right.
Not anything in the future.
Yes. Any further questions? Seeing none, roll call.
McCormick?
Yes.
Weiss?
Yes.
Sedgwick?
Aye.
Bradley?
Yes.
And Shepard?
Yes. Agenda item number 7, review and recommendation of condemnation of property located within R613, R6616, Reserve Ruby Levy Project, and I would make a motion that we go into executive session to discuss these items.
Do you need a second?
And we need a roll call. I need a second on that.
I'll second.
Roll call.
Yes.
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
And Chairperson?
Yeah.
I'll make a motion.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Roll call.
Yeah. No, but the motion's in the handout on the second page. Do you want me to read it?
No, we're going out of exact session.
We're going, yeah, I'll have you read it in a minute. We're going back into session. Go ahead.
Bradley?
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
Please.
Yes.
And Chairperson.
Yeah. Councilor, would you like to read the motion?
Sure. Horse Creek Farms, R613, Track 15. Recommendation to the subcommittee to recommend to the board of directors that the general manager be authorized to execute a purchase agreement with Horse Creek Farms, a Colorado partnership, in the amount of $153,000 for an area containing 33.092 acres of land for the Missouri River R613, R616 levee improvement project, subject to the changes deemed necessary by the general manager, and approval as to form by district legal counsel in exchange for the dismissal with prejudice of Horse Creek Farms' appeal of the condemnation award in District Court of Sarpy County, Nebraska.
We have a board member that would make the motion.
Make that motion.
Okay, second.
I'll second.
Anybody in the general public wish to comment? Directors? Seeing none, roll call.
Bradley?
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
Weiss?
Yes.
Becky?
Yes.
And Chairperson?
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our agenda.